Welcome to The Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. My name is Emma and I'll be your host for today's episode. Today I'm joined by an absolutely fabulous woman, and I always start the podcast episodes by saying that, but I'm just so grateful and so lucky to have so many amazing women who are willing to share their time with me. So anyway, I've got off on a tangent already. I'm joined by an absolutely amazing woman, Serena Nathan. Serena is just one unit shy of qualifying as a counsellor, and I can almost taste it for you. Serena grew up in Perth. She is married and has four children. She's always been interested in the human relationships and interested in how we can be so different, but how we connect, whether that's because of or despite of those differences. And Serena says she's always been a mystery to herself, and that's why psych has been so fascinating as a result. So thank you so much for joining me today, Serena.
Thanks, Emma. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So Serena, I invited you to be part of the podcast because you facilitated at our ADHD event. And so many people, and I was one of them, who really enjoyed hearing you speak.
Thank you.
And I thought maybe we could be nosy and see if we could dig a bit deeper.
Great. Yeah.
So we are going to talk about ADHD and also around what it's like going and changing careers at a more mature age.
Yes. Well, that's two really, really big
questions.
They
really are, I know.
Yeah. So I guess first of all, what it's like being diagnosed. I got diagnosed at the age of 54, mm-hmm. and I'm now 56, and I never ever considered that I might have ADHD, never. I was raised by a woman who I think definitely has ADHD, my mum, and life was normal. She was my mum. That's what we knew. And it was a bit chaotic, but Dad was very organized and calm, and he tempered that chaos. And I guess I've got two younger brothers, and the middle one was diagnosed about 9 years ago with ADHD, and we all thought it was probably a bit, none of us took it, the rest of us didn't really take it seriously. We thought, oh, well, maybe he was just looking for some sort of label for something or other. He's always just been a little bit, we're all different, I guess. And he was also quite unhappy in his relationship at that time. And so we thought maybe he's just unhappy and just wanted some medication. We did not take it seriously. And this is one of the major problems that adults undiagnosed with ADHD have, is the stigma and the assumptions, and there it was, the stigma about mental health, assumptions that are made, and this is not only in a family just loaded with people with ADHD, but Mum was a psychologist, and a pioneer in domestic violence counselling in WA, and so even in a family that you think would...
What is it they say? The mechanic's car's always
broken. Yeah. So I didn't really think of it again. And it was when my oldest daughter was about 25, decided that she identified with symptoms that she'd been seeing on social media. And she had always felt that she was a bit different to everybody else. I had always felt that too, but I had assumed at quite a young age that everybody felt like that, but they were just better at covering it up than me, and I tended to spill out of the edges of stuff, and I got sort of discovered from occasionally of just being too silly or too much or too whatever or not enough this and not enough that, but I thought I just wasn't playing the game as well as everybody else did. Whereas she, I guess we didn't have social media or internet when I was that age, and she was just starting to notice that there was a group of people out there that she felt she was like, and they were the neurodivergent community. So when I accompanied her during COVID to the telehealth appointment with the psychiatrist, it became clear that I she and I shared symptoms that were not the same as the rest of the population. Well, they say it's I've done a deep dive into this, and it's around about 2.5% of adults estimated and 5% of kids, but those stats are probably skewed by the age of the research.
So normally when we do the podcast, I try and I take notes while people are talking, and oh my God, I've got so many things I want to come back to. So there's lots of different things. Can we go back to the idea around growing up with chaos? So that can mean so many things to so many different people. So in my house, chaos means can't have anyone over syndrome, because our house is just so messy, so we can't have anyone over. So when we talk about chaos, that's kind of, that's our joke for that. But chaos can be, I guess in my mind, chaos can be, it can be fun and it can be spontaneous and it can be lively and it can be energetic, or chaos can have the real negative connotations of the, you know, not being able to find anything, or not like that. What some people could consider to be energetic and lively, other people, it's unpredictable and I've got no stability. So what are your thoughts around that idea around chaos when you talk about that?
Chaos. Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess a lot of it was internalized. I'm an X generation and I was a typical latchkey kid. So mum worked, and I mean, I don't even mention dad because I grew up in a time where the dads worked and the mums took care of the kids. Mum and dad were really young when they got together and had me. I think mum was just turned 24, and she'd never lived in Perth before. So she was busy making new friends, and they were partying. I remember many, many nights we went to sleep on friends' parents' beds while the parents all, you know, had a wonderful time partying. I remember that it's a happy memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also remember really clearly again and again being carried in from the car asleep from grandparents' houses and being picked up in the middle of the night from places. And they were busy. There was always dinner parties going on at home with Neil Diamond playing. And And I guess, you know, there was the, now looking back, sort of signs of an ADHD parent with the raw egg in the lunchbox that, you know, just hadn't been cooked, and or no lunch at all, or being forgotten to be picked up. I mean, mum was pretty good, but I guess she was probably white knuckling it through motherhood. And then as I got older, and you know, her attention was split by two younger brothers that I had, and I was, you know, there was the youngest one would call out for me when he woke up in the morning. So I know I was sort of put in charge at the age of five of caring for a baby, not put in charge, but and I was very willing
to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So and I knew that was something that I was wanting. I wasn't parentified, you know, against my will, or I loved that role of somebody needing me. And we just ran wild. We were wild kids. We were allowed, mum would be busy with study or work or talking. She talked on the phone to her friends a lot, and the phones were all tethered back then. And we weren't allowed in the house on a Wednesday afternoon because that's when the cleaning lady came. And mum and dad would leave for months at a time. We got left for a couple of months when I was about 10 or 12. With the next door neighbor's daughter and her boyfriend. And
she was, wow.
Yeah, and that was for, I think, 10 weeks, 12, yeah, or yeah, maybe 2 months. And she was 21, and so was he.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so they were kids, and we were all kids, and I was the oldest at 12. And another time they went traveling for a few months, and they packed us up to a cousin's station, and we did school on air for a few months up there. And my littlest brother was only 3. You know, it was...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Some of those things are... They're around that time, you know. So I remember my mum being on the phone to one of her friends, and same kind of thing, tethered to the wall type of thing. And I heard her friend kind of shriek, and mum's going, "What's wrong?" And she goes, "Oh, it's okay. I've just set the kitchen on fire." Mum goes, "Do you need to go?" She goes, "No, no. It's burnt now." So
You know, that kind of thing of kids playing outside till it goes dark. And it's hard, isn't it, to distinguish what is it that was part of that time and what is it that may have been part of growing up in a household that had ADHD?
I think the chaotic part was that none of it was explained. None of it was – we would lurch from one moment to the next.
Yeah.
And if I did try to find – you know, if I did say I don't want to take my clothes off in the middle of Target because – and try this dress on – it was, I just got, oh, don't be so ridiculous. No one cares what you look like without your clothes on. But that wasn't really the point, you know.
Yeah, no, that's right, yeah.
But there was no time to catch up with that thought. And I was scrambling all the time.
Yeah.
And I got really down as a older teenager. I would have been maybe 16, 17. And Mum took me to see a friend of hers who was a psychologist. And she did an intelligence test with me, and I didn't ever get the results, she didn't talk to me about it that I can remember, but I do remember that Mum being told that I would probably make it through school, but I would probably not make it through tertiary education, or I would struggle really badly. So I was basically told that I was a bit dumb, and it confirmed what I suspected, because I found it really hard to concentrate at school, and I daydreamed a lot and I zoned out a lot. I got yelled at quite a bit by teachers for not concentrating. Otherwise, I was a pleasure to have in the classroom, so I wasn't really disruptive.
Yeah,
but I found it hard to focus, and the others didn't. They didn't seem to find that. It was only me. I mean, the boys would get in trouble and they'd get the cane, but they were being naughty. They were playing out. I just don't remember. You know, there was a few girls, I guess, but I did learn to appear to be focused and concentrating, but it didn't really help with my schoolwork. And
I'm getting told off less, but I'm not getting better grades.
Yeah, yeah. And there were a couple, you know, one when I was in year eight, I had an English teacher who was inspirational. Mm. And from then on, I was really good at English.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved it. And I did really, really well in English because I was encouraged.
And inspired.
Yeah. And it was really interesting because, So, yeah, does that sort of...
Yeah. Another thing that you said going back was around the concept of labels. And I'm wondering, so there is a stigma with labels, isn't there? And some people really want labels and some people really don't want labels. And now I guess what I'm hearing a lot is, oh, my God, every woman's getting diagnosed with ADHD. Is this actually a real thing, or is this actually just what being a woman is like?
Mm.
And so it's almost like the more we raise awareness about it, the more we're actually going, actually, it's just women trying to get attention, or it's just... it's an excuse. They just want to be labelled. And so have you experienced any of that?
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, in women, because of the way that the symptoms interact with hormones, it's at the times of their lives that are most confusing that ADHD symptoms tend to be at their worst. So puberty and around the time of having children, raising a family, being pregnant and having postpartum. Young children. Yeah. Yeah. And then again around menopausal age, which for these days a lot of women are still got teenagers living at home and parents are aging. Life is really complicated at these three key times. And so there's a lot of women who may suspect that they have ADHD because the message is starting to filter through that it is a persistent disorder that does not abate with age. And in fact, the symptoms of inattentive type ADHD tend to get worse with age, not better. And the more hyperactive symptoms it looks like they tend to settle down with age, but it may be a combination of of that and internalization of those of that hyperactivity. So I, you know, I have clients who suspect that they may have ADHD and they're in that perinatal phase of life, and they were fine with pregnancy, they were fine with a baby, they were even fine with a toddler. But once they've added a second baby, when as things get more complex and they're still trying to manage a romantic, mutually satisfying relationship at the same time, it just gets too much. Mm. And so then the shame sets in and then they hear stuff in the media that women are looking for a diagnosis in order to explain away just not being very good at mothering.
Yeah.
Or being a partner, you know, and then the shame guilt cycle
spirals,
just keeps on going, and they get quieter, or they just keep trying harder, and because they're now in this shame cycle, things just keep getting worse, and then they might get diagnosed with anxiety and depression, and of course they're anxious, and of course they're depressed. And they're looking around at their friends and they seem to be doing so much better. There's a lot of women on antidepressants who would benefit, who just shouldn't be on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not saying that everybody who's taking antidepressants shouldn't be on antidepressants, just that there's certainly a lot of women who have been misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
Who perhaps ADHD might be a more suitable diagnosis, and maybe if they explored that more, the anxiety would lessen and there wouldn't be a need for those meds.
Yeah, and I'm not antidepressants at all. I think there's a very, very important place for that and for all medication.
Yeah,
for,
that's exactly it.
And the research is robust in most cases, but because women go through a number of women are complicated because they've got this hormone activity, because they tend to be the mask of motherhood means that their primary carers, who are also expected to provide financially, maintain great careers, it's just very, very difficult time for women. And it's also a difficult time for men. You know, they're negotiating a lot of change as well. I'm not discounting that. It's just that my focus is on women.
I've been working with women for the last 20 years. My focus is on women. We're all good. Mm. So how do you think that social media posts like the ones that your daughter saw, how do you think they are impacting women who are sort of starting to go, like, so I'll be honest, there's a lot of them that my ADHD friends are posting and I'm like, doesn't everybody experience life like that? Like, I thought that was normal. So I'm wondering, how do you think that those kinds of posts are impacting people?
I think social media gets a really bad rap in the medical world for misinformation. But I do think there is a lot of awareness building that goes on in social media that speeds up the process of awareness for women in a way that nothing before ever has. I think it's, in some ways, it is fantastic. And I also think it, because it's a first-person lived experience, these TikToks and Instagram Reels, all that sort of stuff, and I'm up to date with all the apps. It's because it's firsthand, up to the minute lived experience, you are getting a bird's eye view into many, many people's personal experience. And what that helps promote is the heterogeneity of conditions like ADHD, where everybody experiences it differently. Mm-hmm. And because you might be, if your algorithm has led you more and more down that path, you're going to be seeing a lot of different experiences with executive dysfunction. For instance, for me, working memory is a really big problem, really big problem. And I actually, before my diagnosis, I really did think that I had the early stages of dementia, and wondering how I was going to hide that, you know. I really did. And that's one of the reasons I decided to go and pursue it, just get checked out, because I was so worried it was something worse. So memory is very bad for me. But there are other people that you'll come across on TikTok or on social media, and their working memory is fine, but they have terrible problems with what's another executive function? Well, you know, they may their rejection sensitivity, which is not officially a symptom, but is becoming more and more accepted as a part and parcel of ADHD. Some people struggle really badly with that, I guess because of my age partly, and also I've had quite a bit of therapy myself. I tend to be a bit better in that area. Yeah, I think social media has been fantastic. It's also perpetuated some of the stigma with people saying, well, see, it's just because of social media. And
yeah, that's exactly it.
It's a bandwagon and everyone's just wanting pills to make them think faster. And I mean, the pills that make you think faster are great, you know, but for someone who doesn't think fast or thinks much, you can tell by the way I'm talking, my brain and mouth don't communicate very well. But what it does is the stimulants bring you up to speed with the rest of the population. There's no advantage.
Yeah.
And if you don't have ADHD and your executive functioning is normal and your thinking is convergent, it's just a party drug.
So you miss out on all of the exciting party drug parts of the meds if you have ADHD.
In fact, there's quite a few younger women who decide to pursue a diagnosis because they do the party drugs. You know, people are passing around Dexies at a party and they take a couple and they immediately feel focused, calm. Their thinking slows down. Yeah. They're able to process thoughts one at a time. And while their friends are all, woohoo, this is fun, they're feeling like they could actually write a complex literature review, you know, because they would be able
to
think.
That's exactly what you want to do at a party.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something that requires organisation of thought and step-by-step process.
Yeah.
That's the advantage of medication for many people who take it who don't have that without it.
Yeah. And just one more thing that came up that I'm just going to touch on quickly or ask you to touch on quickly. So we hear often that girls and women are just better at masking. And so that's why the, you know, people are now being diagnosed in later life because they've masked everything so well. Do you think, and something you brought up before is around these the social constructs of the way that men and women behave differently. So I was wondering, why is it that girls mask and boys don't? And I know that some boys do mask, but I'm wondering, do you think it's around the social constructs of the way that women are expected to behave and the societal expectations around that, that women do learn to mask it? Whereas, sweeping generalization, but men are not expected to behave in the same kinds of way. Therefore, they get to be just whoever they are and they don't have to make it feel okay for everybody around them.
That's right. Yeah. So it's that's an intergenerational problem. And yeah, women are expected. I've got one of my kids, she's got ADHD, and if she was a boy, you know, some of her risk-taking behaviours and some of the wild stuff she does, she would just be a wild colonial boy. You know, it'd be like, oh, that's my boy.
Yeah.
But because she's a girl, she finds that one of the things that in retrospect when she started high school or when she was about year 6, 7, in primary school she would run around and play chasey and climb trees and do all the stuff that both boys and girls did. But the girls started to peter off.
Yeah.
And she's never stopped wanting that level of excitement and that type of fun. It's very physical. So she found when she went to, for a while, she went to an all-girls school and she was miserable because she said all they do at lunchtime is they sit
and talk. Yeah.
And she there was a game that she used to play at primary school, mostly with the boys, and they didn't want to play the game. And so she has found it hard to maintain friendships with girls because she doesn't do what girls are expected to do, and she's less able to fit the mold than I was. I was able to reinvent myself to be a normal little girl, and my older daughter, sadly, I guess, was also able to do that really well. So we were able to alter ourselves to fit what society expected us to be. Whereas the youngest, maybe she's a digital native, you know, maybe social media has helped her to not do that. Or maybe she's, I don't know. But
sometimes I think that's also being the youngest, right?
Yeah, youngest child, yeah. And also the youngest child has different parents, you know, she gets away with a lot more. Yeah. But I think that the expectations, you know, there's a psychologist in, she's a PhD, her name's Dr. Sophie Brock. She's an Australian psychologist and she has this theory of motherhood, which is a fishbowl theory of motherhood. And the idea is that, you know, the woman is the fish and a fish doesn't know it's swimming in water. Mm. And the water is all of society's expectations. And so sometimes I'll be talking to my clients and if we're talking about the expectations that society has on them, half of them neither of us are aware of. I'm not, because it's so thin and invisible, and it's like a thin veil. It's so ingrained from generations and generations. And because I don't feel like I'm masking anymore, and I don't feel like I need the camouflage anymore, but I know it's still there. I know it's still well in place.
Well, you said you were diagnosed at 54. You started going through the process at 54. Mm. So that's 5.5 decades of practicing that. And even let's say you didn't start practicing that, but we do. We learn to those ingrained things literally from birth.
Mm.
And you look at the toys that girls get given as opposed to what boys get given. All of that stuff impacts us. So it's 5.5 decades worth of unlearning.
The other thing, you know, one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot is promiscuity. There's a lot of dangers for girls with ADHD. Because of risky behaviour, the consequences, those dangers, the risky behaviour is the same for boys. But boys who are promiscuous tend to
be celebrated?
Maybe even if not celebrated, nobody really expects that much different. Mm. That's just that's all that boys think about. So what did you expect?
Yeah.
But when girls behave in that same way, they are called sluts.
Yeah.
You know, It's very hard for girls to not play the game.
Mm.
It's very hard for girls to have problems that are expressed in ways that ADHD tends to do that. Yeah, people with ADHD, their life expectancy is less than everybody else's.
Ah, is that because of the risky behaviour?
And so
I'm wondering whether or not as well.
It's like about 15 years.
Oh, wow.
So there's a...
That's significant.
Yeah. And it's not from one particular thing, but yeah, what you've touched on is right. I mean, risk of suicide, particularly in girls, is much, much higher with ADHD, but also risky behaviours like jumping off a bridge, train surfing, that sort of, you know, the kids you see on the news to riding on the top of the trains, guaranteed they've got ADHD. There's also things that are less obvious, like not attending perinatal health appointments.
Because you forget.
Yeah. And not going to the dentist or the doctor, you know, not taking care of your health, being more impulsive and making bad choices in diet.
Yeah.
So, you know, increased risk of cancer and heart disease, being much more prone to addiction as a coping, maladaptive coping strategies, we call them, but they all serve a purpose, which is to try and alleviate some sort of pain or anxiety or bad feeling. So lots of smokers, drink alcoholics and drug takers. You know, there's a lot.
Asking a personal question, and you don't have to answer this, but once you were diagnosed, are there things that you did when you were younger that you're like, that makes sense now?
Yes. Because I was so ancient when I got diagnosed, all the workarounds...
At no point did I say that or insinuate it at all.
No, but you know, like people talk about late diagnosis and they're 23. I think that lady, come and talk to me. I had the workarounds that, you know, everyone has to develop their own because it's different for everybody. So anyone who says, oh, this is what works for ADHD... That's just what works for them and maybe one other person that they've got feedback from. Yeah, the planners and the... anyway, that's a whole nother thing, but...
I'm quickly coming to the... slowly coming to the realisation that you actually have to use the planners, not just buy them.
Yeah.
It's really unfortunate. I've tried having one in every colour, but still doesn't work if you don't use it.
That's the thing. The workarounds I've got, like I had, by the time I got diagnosed, I had worked out that there is no planner that works for me.
Yeah.
Because I tried them all. But it's not my thing. I cannot do it.
I so want to be that person though, right?
Yeah, I know. It would be lovely. But and one of my daughters has a paper. She uses a paper diary and it's beautiful. It's all just coloured and it looks gorgeous and that works for her. And I've bought my own. She's bought me some. It just doesn't work. I can't do it. I just use the calendar on my phone and I use notes. I'm dictating notes. I've got thousands of notes in the notes app. That's all I use. I guess, what was the question?
So, when you're looking back.
Yeah, looking back. Yes, there are. My husband, I've been married 30 years, and I think now looking back, I intentionally chose him because he is extremely convergent in his thinking. He can compartmentalize beautifully and he is patient. All the things that I needed in my life, I've been able to get through that relationship. And we've had plenty of counselling to stay married. You know, it's not easy. My restlessness, when I got diagnosed, I was told I had combined type and I thought, no, that can't be right. I have no hyperactivity at all. I'm so lazy. By the way, I actually don't think laziness exists. I do not think it exists.
No.
I don't think it's a thing. And I just love lying on the couch and watching telly. But I realised that my hyperactivity comes out in things like moving furniture. Mm. And that's a really common one for women. And it doesn't mean you've got ADHD, but it's compulsive and it has to happen there and immediately. It's cost us a lot of money, my ADHD. I love driving. I've never got bored of driving, but I get bored of cars quite easily. You know, I've changed cars quite a lot. I guess, we did live in one house for about 13 years, but prior to that we'd lived in about four for about 3 years at a time. And it's this restlessness. I get bored in, I think, oh, this is the career I want and I'm going to be a florist and I'm going to be a writer and I'll be a journalist, I'll be a broadcaster, I'll be a teacher, and I've got the training to back all this stuff up. Like, I'm really well trained and educated, so much for struggling through uni.
I was going to say, have you got the hex debt to back that up as well?
Well, a lot of it I did while it was still free.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have clocked up a bit of that though. But because I flip and switch and quit, and I have never actually earned enough to get the hex debt started.
It's one of the benefits. And also, when you die, it doesn't get passed on to your children, so it goes with you.
Yeah.
So, I'm holding on to that. So,
Yeah.
So you have changed careers often?
Yeah, heaps. And I until now, even though I haven't even quite finished, I've been on prac and now volunteering as a counsellor for 6 months, 7 months. This is it. By now, I normally know it's not it, and this feels like a culmination of everything I've been working towards, and it was like a perfect storm. When I started, I was confused, I was depressed, I was so anxious. I thought, I've wanted to do this for so many decades, and I was brave enough to give it a shot. And when I enrolled in the Masters of Counselling at Notre Dame, I went to the university and said, are you sure you want me? I don't think you realise. I thought you should meet me so you just at the admissions office.
Do you want an out?
yeah. Are you sure? And they said, no, we're happy to have you and your money.
Yeah.
But when I started, I thought, I will do this course and I'll enjoy it, but I will never apply for a job. I will never work in the field, because that was the pattern. I would expect a lot of myself. I develop perfectionist tendencies just by virtue of trying very, very hard to fit in.
Mm.
and also never quite fitting in the way that I saw other people fitting in.
Yeah.
I can't do small talk. I just can't do it, and I still can't. But now it's okay. I hate small talk, and I can do it, but if I'm at a place where it's only small talk, my partner knows that I'm likely to stay for half an hour, 40 minutes tops, and then I'm out. And
that's good, because I start with, like, I think, okay, so there's small talk, and then I'm going to ask really deep questions, and that is perhaps not great at a barbecue with people who you've never met before. So.
You can often find someone who's happy to sit in a corner, and in fact, I used to smoke, and that was one of the really nice things about smoking. The smokers would be outside, and often it was a one-on-one, and that was a situation I was comfortable in. So smoking was really useful for that. Unless the other smoker would just, you know, just want to chit chat.
Out of luck, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another thing I now look back on and I realise. And again, there's plenty of people who just like to have meaty conversations who don't have ADHD. This is one of the reasons why the stigma is so intense, is because all of the symptoms are things that people experience some of the time.
Yeah.
All of them. Everyone. The difference, you know, the amount of times people say, but doesn't everyone do that? And the true answer is yes, they do. But for people with ADHD, it's so often so intense and so debilitating, it's constant.
Yeah.
And the level of exhaustion in trying to manage that means that you've probably got about a half day of energy compared to other people.
Yeah. And I guess it's, you know, we talk often about the mental load. It's the additional layer of the mental load that goes with that as well.
It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. It is exhausting. And the brain has to work really, really hard. Like when people talk about mental load, that's mental load. A high mental load is physically exhausting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got your year 12 kids who go through their final exams and they eat like a horse, and they, you know, they sleep well, and it's because it's physically, it's like running a marathon. So if you are scrambling to keep up with everybody, just to think straight and talk straight and, you know, be able to start a task, be able to finish a task, if that's a struggle for you 10 times a day, you're exhausted.
Yeah.
And what we know now about sleep is that it's restorative physically and mentally. So if you are exhausted because you're trying to live a normal life, and you, also ADHD is characterized by sleep problems. So you're not able to sleep very well. And then a doctor says to you, I think you're depressed. I think you've got anxiety. Yeah, you probably just need 2 weeks of really, really good sleep, but even that's not going to cut it. You know, it's very, very difficult to explain.
Yeah, and I mean, what's the chances that you're going to get 2 weeks of sleep? If it is, sign me up. But I think as well, when we talk about fatigue and exhaustion, it's not just about lack of sleep. You know, like having a nap isn't going to fix it.
No.
It's so much deeper than that.
I think that's where there's a sadness there as well, and feeling that there's no fix. It's just you're going to just have to live like this forever, which is not the case. There are ways of learning how to really enjoy who you are and the way you live, and for it not to be a problem.
Mm.
Yeah, which, you know, Women's Health and Wellbeing Service runs classes often back to back on programs like self-compassion.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing that's really helpful for people with ADHD, whether you take medication or not. That sort of thing is that's really the cure, is learning how to know yourself genuinely and authentically and appreciate that.
And look, to be fair, I think every woman should do that because all of the societal pressures that I was talking about before, actually, what if we stop comparing ourselves to the way that society says that we should? And what about if we actually celebrated who we are? And if that's not okay for somebody, then don't spend time with that person find your tribe who are going to love and celebrate you for who you actually are and your authentic self. And we just need to do more of that.
Mm, and what you said about find your tribe, that's really relevant to self-compassion because one of the three core elements of self-compassion is common humanity, which is often, even if you can't find your tribe, you can find others who think like you and who want to understand you and who feel lonely like women often feel. Yeah. Women, I think loneliness in the perinatal stage is a really big problem, and it's you know, lack of sharing comes from what you were talking about earlier, the social expectations that just get passed down. Yeah,
I think loneliness in my life stage is huge as well. So my children are now, so my eldest is 18 and my youngest is 11. And there are so many women who are, whether it's the same age as me, I started having children a bit younger than a lot of people in my mother's group did, but whether it's the same, but it's the same stage where your children are starting to get older. And so many women are going, well, how do I make friends when I'm 40 or 50 or 30? All of my friends, you know, my friends that I had pre-children have drifted away. My friends that I, turns out all my friends were my children's parents, my children's friends' parents. And now we don't, you know, we don't do this drop-offs anymore. I don't know who I am if I'm not that person's parent. How do I can't go up to somebody, you know, a six-year-old can go up to someone in the playground and go, hey, do you want to be my friend? Well, I can't walk up to a woman at BWS and go, oh, I like that one. Do you want to be my friend?
So, yeah.
And I'm all for that. I think we should do more of that.
Yeah.
But loneliness it's so big for women. Mm. And, you know, women as they're exiting careers now find out, well, my social circle was people I worked with, and yes, we started out catching up once a fortnight, once a month, but now it's been 6 months and I haven't seen anyone.
Mm.
So I think throughout the stages, loneliness is just, it seems to be kind of a repetitive pattern that seems to happen.
Well, it's increasing in younger generations for the first time ever. So normally it's seen in older generations, it's normal for loneliness to increase at a certain rate, and I don't have the stats on hand, but
I can't think why, given it was nothing that we were supposed to be talking about.
For the first time, well, like, yeah, I've got a file on the floor next to me, but I haven't opened it. I don't know what's in there. I just grabbed a random file.
I just wanted to look prepared.
No. Yeah. I've got a pen, but there's nothing to write on. I did read I read a lot of science journals. I'm an over-researcher that... It's the first time they've seen an increase in loneliness in, I think it was the millennials, it could be Gen Z, but it was, you know, a younger generation.
Mm.
And it's become there is a guy in New York, and he's a politician, he might be a mayor anyway, I'll find out for the notes if you like. Yes, and please. He's written a book on loneliness, and he's a psychiatrist, I think. Anyway, I will find out details on that. Mm. But he's done some very interesting research somewhere, and it's evidence-based research. So loneliness is a problem, and you know, the pandemic hasn't caused that, because what you're talking about, that life stage loneliness when there's no school pickup and book clubs have died off a bit, that probably predates the pandemic. It's probably not just in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah,
but the pandemic has accelerated everyone's ability to notice that, and
it's also a really good excuse for literally everything. You know, COVID. I'm like, really? Are we? Yeah, we can't actually blame it for everything. No. So
we can't really blame it for anything, because all it's done is illuminate problems that were already there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for those. I would say an exception is those babies that were COVID babies. It's a different very early childhood for them than.
Yeah, and for those mothers or parents as well, you know, their pregnancy experience and their birth experience and all of that, most definitely there's issues that come from that. And also the fear that comes for those parents about what socialisation could possibly mean.
Mm.
So there's all of that kind of stuff that, yes, I will pay that's COVID-related or pandemic-related, but the rest of it, I agree, I think the problems have been there. It's just... they're highlighted.
Which is actually how, that's a good analogy for, you know, this attitude of, oh, COVID, all of a sudden there's all these people saying they've got ADHD. How come there's this sudden rise in it? Given that it's probably a combination of genes and environmental causes like trauma, it's probably, maybe there has been a bit of a rise, but it's probably that it's always been like that, but it's just never been acknowledged. Mm. It's always been passed off as something else. And the pandemic just simply served to make it what was almost unbearable, made it actually unbearable, those symptoms.
Mm. Tell me about that. Why would the pandemic have made those symptoms unbearable?
Because I think that there was a lot of people who relied on certain structures, like their book club or their going to the supermarket and socialising there, particularly even those who are socially more withdrawn. They may not have realised it, but they were getting their socialisation fix at the hairdresser, the coffee shop, it's like incidental exercise, parking a long way away. You could socialise less, but still get that fix. And so when that stopped and those other older structures of friendship may have fallen away.
Oh, yeah. So I'm with you on the socialisation thing. I thought you were saying that ADHD became unmanageable during
COVID. Well, people were then, for a lot of reasons, that other things also became unmanageable, like domestic violence. You know, there was no escape for women who were in danger. Just trying to think how ADHD would be affected. For some, it would have been taking everything online would have been complicated. You know, no face-to-face lectures, depending on your style of learning, that you know, it's very, very hard for visual learners to do that type of thing over Zoom without the face-to-face aspect. What else?
I'm wondering whether or not, as you said, the lack of structure. And so, you know, for some people, they've got routines in place that I go to work, and once I get to work, I do this, and I know that this is my most productive time, so I get this done. And then, but if I'm not actually having to get dressed and go to work, then it's really easy to not do the thing that makes me do the thing that makes me actually use my productive window. And all of a sudden, I've just binge-watched 6 episodes of something and I was supposed to be working and now...
Yeah, and it may be because people are really easily distracted with ADHD, that being in the home as the office, there's the washing machine and there's the kitchen sink and there's, you know, the floor needs vacuuming again and whatever it is. There's so many jobs that you can distract yourself with when things get boring at work in your living room.
So going all the way back to... You enrolled in this course. So what do you think do you think that it's different this time because you're diagnosed with ADHD?
Yeah, I actually do. I want to say no, but...
You want to say no, this is my life's purpose and I've just, you know, the realisation happened.
Well, no, I
want to
say it's because of all the therapy I've had and, you know, I started seeing a counsellor again when I started this, the Masters. I thought it had been a long time since I had counselling. I'd had counselling a long time previously. I lost one of my children, died in 2004, and I saw a counsellor then and stuck with it for 8 years, and it was really helpful. So, you know, now it's 20 years later, and I thought, well...
Oh, my goodness, 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost. And I thought, well, to be a good counsellor, I remembered how terrifying it was going to counselling.
Yeah.
And had the dread of walking in, and then the need to... It was next door to a bookshop, and I used to have to spend half an hour at least walking around the bookshop. I got to know the owner of the bookshop really well because I was there week after week just wandering around like a zombie for half an hour just trying to repaginate afterwards again. Yeah. It can be really challenging.
Yeah.
And so it had been such a long time. I wanted to experience that again. Mm. And so I started that process, and... While seeing this counsellor, I'd gone through my daughter's going through this, what maybe I do? And sort of went through all that as a patient in counselling, as well as a student, where I was allowed to choose the subject matter for my lit review and my design for a group, which I did ADHD.
Yeah.
And I was able to make ADHD a real focus academically. So as I got treated, my motivation increased exponentially, and it's stayed like that. I mean, it must be nearly 2 years. I think it's 2 years. Mm. Yeah, it is. My maths is terrible, and my sense of time. There is now, and there is not now.
Yeah.
I mean, we could have been talking for 7 hours or 10 minutes.
That's it's a little bit in between that, but yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean.
I just don't. Yeah. I do not have a sense of time. So I was excited and motivated, and I was being treated, and I was being validated, and I was reassured by my grades that I'm smart.
Yeah.
I was reassured by medication that I'm not lazy, because I can still flop on the couch and watch 6 hours straight.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm being modest.
Yeah.
Of Netflix.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, there's more than one series I've watched the entire season in one sitting.
Yeah, that's why I don't watch American TV shows, because there's 20 episodes, 23 episodes. So that's 23 hours gone and I haven't moved.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah. As long as there's enough chocolate around me.
Yeah.
So all the reasons I had to feel sadder and smaller and more likely to quit or to not even try, all of those reasons pretty much evaporated.
Mm.
And then it was a case of learning how to not talk so meanly to myself. And that's an ongoing process, and I still struggle a lot with that. But that'll get there.
Yeah, it's practice. And the more we practice, the more that becomes second nature, and the more we learn to speak to ourselves the way we would speak to a friend.
Even on prac, my supervisor has had to constantly, I can almost feel her rolling her eyes as she says, yes, we do appreciate you. Yes, yes, we do like having you here. Because I must be saying things that, like, you know, oh, well, if I'm still around, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So there's still that, it's a habitual dismissing of myself. And I think that's partly being a woman and an older woman, and partly being having ADHD.
How hard was it to actually, so given you spoke about changing careers and starting courses and not finishing them, and the way that you shared that makes me feel like there you may have experienced shame as a, you know, around feeling like there's failure there and dropping out. How was it with that, having the courage to actually go back and start again?
It was really tough, really tough. I guess that was a pandemic advantage. I didn't have anyone giving me negative feedback about that. I've got a really, really supportive partner, and I'm also in a financial situation where I could afford not to work and to go and study. I'm just really lucky, just such so much privilege. So, and I also live like in the next street from the university.
That's really helpful. Yeah.
So, although, yeah, it was online, a lot of it. But I think I got to a point, and this is partly being in my mid-50s, where I thought, oh, I don't want to swear, but I thought, oh, fudge it. I'm too old to be bothered with what people think of me, and if I can't hack it, then so be it. I'll give it a go. I think you get braver in some ways. Yeah, maybe you do get braver. People talk about how, oh, we just don't care. Once you turn 50, you don't really care. I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think it's a script we women all follow because we get so tired of the fear and feeling inadequate that we sort of cast it off. I don't know how deep that casting off is though.
Yeah, and how much it's just, like you say, lip service. Mm. But maybe you still care what people think, you just care what you think more, or you just are able to give it less weight so that you can feel like you can do it anyway.
I think when you practice real self-compassion, it's not about whether you care or not. That's not the point. You start to focus on what gives you some joy and does it give other people joy as well? Is that something that is involved? It's not actually to do with what you think of yourself or what other people think of you. It's not about introspection or feeling judged or approved of. That's not it. It just doesn't factor in.
Mm.
It's that I get this deep satisfaction out of spending that 50 minutes with a client, and that the incredible privilege of them allowing me into their inner world and trusting me with that stuff. And I can appreciate the satisfaction they get when I'm able to help them see something in themselves that can either change the direction they're going to or reinforces something that they're doing that's good that they're not sure about, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not actually about what anyone thinks of anyone or what I think about myself. It's that just it ceases to be part of the equation. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's a really beautiful way to put it. So because I know that you do actually have to head back upstairs and see a client really soon, and I mean, it's great and I'm really grateful that you're doing that, but also I'm really enjoying talking to you. So I'm going to work hard to wrap up. If you were to meet somebody who was, you know, I'm going to say a later diagnosis but older than 20, who thought, hey, actually I've seen some of these things on socials and I'm ticking some of these boxes, what would your advice be to them?
My advice would be, okay, you are already doing too much. Slow down. Slow down. Yes, you have taken on too much. You are smarter than you think. You are not lazy and you are probably a lot of fun, and let's go out for a drink.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't really drink anymore, but let's...
You can still go out for a lemonade or a mocktail.
Yeah. And I would say that the big one is where you think you're failing, you are just trying to take on too much and you have got to slow down, slow everything down. And I would also just say, just try and prioritize your sleep, get some exercise, eat well. Do you know all the boring things that you don't want to hear? They are there. They're cliches for a reason. But, you know, like Ken says, you are enough. You're enough just the way you are. Nothing needs to change about you. That's the big takeaway. You are perfect exactly as you are right now.
I'm not even going to add anything to that because that's a perfect ending. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you answering all of these questions and sharing so much.
Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of A Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. For more information on the services we offer, head to whws.org.au or Women's Health and Wellbeing Services on YouTube and social media. Looking forward to the next episode where we uncover the hidden world of women.